Let's turn to Genesis chapter 5 and we'll continue through the Bible, finding ourselves in the book of Genesis. As you've heard me say for some weeks now, that really nothing in life makes any sense in terms of what we see day in and day out apart from the first five chapters of Genesis. And we've looked at an awful lot of things in terms of what all that means over the prior 4 weeks. But the reason that chapter 5 is so important for us in terms of understanding what it is that we run into day in and day out and what we're exposed to day in and day out is that chapter 5 deals with this subject of death. To walk through chapter 5 of Genesis is to walk through a cemetery. It is to walk by tombstone after tombstone after tombstone. And tombstones are known really for providing us with the barest of information concerning an individual. And that's all that chapter 5 does for us, is provide us with the barest of information concerning virtually all of the individuals named there, except for one in particular, who we'll take a look at a little more closely when we get to him. One of the things that my brother and I used to do as a kid, we were fairly unsupervised, and summers are long, weekends are long. Well, where do you spend some of your time? You spend your time catching blue-bellied lizards and bees and blowing up everything, breaking every piece of glass you can find, and these kind of things that constitute a childhood for most boys. But one of the things that we used to do when we were desperate for free fun, and we didn't have any money, so it all had to be free, was that we would just go and ride through the cemetery. It was a weird job. Yeah. But we'd ride through fascinated by these tombstones. Look how important this person must have been. Look at the size of this thing and the cherubim that are in there. And we'd walk into the mausoleums and we'd walk into the places where they put the ashes and just think, on the other side of this marble there's somebody's ashes. And the things that excite a young mind, and we would look around and see that there were graves that were unmarked, and to wonder, you know, why that would be the case and all. But all that these tombstones would ever yield to us was the name of the person that was there and basically how long they lived. And that's all that chapter 5 really tells us about the individuals that we look at. Gives us their name and tells us how long they live. And the Bible here in this particular chapter, it really answers the question for us, why in the world do people die? And that's a good question. That's a good question for the evolutionist. That's a good question for the philosopher. That's the good question for the student of the Bible. It's a good question for all of mankind. Why do men die? Why does it appear that just about 100 out of every 100 people that die live ultimately die? This seems to be a widespread phenomenon, seems to be all-inclusive. Well, why do we die? Why doesn't man just go on endlessly? Why didn't he evolve into something that didn't know death? Why does this thing called death exist? And the Bible gives us a very clear explanation why. And the reason that mankind dies is because every member of mankind is in Adam. He is a descendant of Adam. And the Bible tells us that in Adam, everyone dies. But the Bible teaches also that in Christ, there is eternal life. The Bible teaches that there are really two men that have, in the history of mankind, been born alive. And that first man was Adam. And the second man, Jesus is described as the second man. The second man is Jesus. Because in a very real sense, they are the only two in the history of mankind that have been born alive the way that God sees man as of necessity being alive, and that is being alive spiritually. Only Adam was spiritually alive in his birth, and only Jesus was spiritually alive in his birth. All of the rest of us are born into this world spiritually dead. And so in Adam, everybody dies. And so you look around and you say, you look at the fact that every one of us will die if the Lord tarries, and all it is proof of the fact that you and I are in Adam. We are descendants of Adam. And that's why we die. Now, mankind has an interesting way of dealing with death. He doesn't deal with it very well. He hasn't quite figured out a way to deny its existence just yet. But we'll give them a little more time, and they'll come up with something. But they are confronted with this issue of death, and it's an uncomfortable issue, because the fact of the matter is that death needs to be conquered. Death is an enemy. Death is your enemy. Death is my enemy. Jesus said it was an enemy to all of us. He needs to be conquered. In fact, in the Bible, as it talks about death, death is almost personified as a person, one that tracks us down, one that hunts us down, one who is desirous for us. And so he is an enemy. And it's interesting to me that as God spoke concerning what God we would follow, he said in Isaiah, and we've already seen this in prior weeks, he said, whatever God is worthy of being followed, he ought to be able to tell us the former things with 100% accuracy. He ought to be able to answer questions like, why are we here? How did we get here? These kind of fundamental questions of life. And not only should he be able to tell us the former things, but he should tell us the things that are going to come to pass before they come to pass, so that when they come to pass with 100% accuracy, we might know that then this is worthy of being called God. And so a very simple test that he puts out for deity, for anyone to follow something that we want to call God, he ought to be able to do that. Do both of those things. In other words, exhibit the fact that this God is bigger than the time domain, bigger than the finite, and is infinite, bigger than the creation, and thus worthy of worship. Now, Jesus adds a third thing, and those two things we've been through in prior chapters. Jesus adds a third requirement that we ought to make of anyone that we would follow as a God. And they came to him, the religious leaders, and they came to him and they said, show us a sign that you are the promised one, that you are the anointed one, that you are the Messiah. And Jesus looked at the religious leaders and he had given them plenty of signs. He had been fulfilling prophecy for 3.5 years before their eyes. They had plenty of signs that he was the Messiah. But he spoke to them and said, an evil and an adulterous generation seeks after a sign. And he said, no sign will be given unto it except the sign of Jonah the prophet. And as Jonah was 3 days and 3 nights in the belly of the great fish, so shall the Son of Man be 3 days and 3 nights in the center of the earth. Speaking of his death, but also speaking of his resurrection, that he would only be there for 3 days, speaking of the fact that he would conquer death. And so no one ought to worship any God who cannot tell us the former things with 100% accuracy, the things that are to come with 100% accuracy, and he must have conquered death. Now you can take all of creation, everything, and sift it through that sifter, that deity sifter, and there is only one who survives it, and that is the person of Jesus Christ. He is the only one who is worthy of our worship. And one of the reasons is he's conquered death. And tonight, this moment in time, he has the keys of death and hell. He's conquered them both. They're on his keychain. They have keychains in heaven? I don't know. But he has both of those keys, and he's the only one that has those keys, and he's the only one that is able to free us from those things. And the Bible teaches that mankind lives in the bondage of the fear of death. It is one of the great fears of mankind. One of the things that every person apart from Jesus Christ lives under is guilt. They live under loneliness. They've been created for fellowship with God, and they are lonely until we are in that relationship. A person that is apart from Jesus Christ is empty because he has been created for fellowship with God, and his life will be empty and frustrating until he is doing that for which he has been created. And he will also have a fear of death. Everyone has a fear of death. Everyone understands that it's an enemy, and only Jesus has conquered the enemy. Now, mankind is, as I've said, very interesting in how he deals with this. And until I can find a superior illustration to the one that I read several years ago, I'm stuck with it, for those of you who've been around for a while. There's a hospital in Southern California that decided to deal with this whole death issue in a very creative way. They decided that they would no longer call death, death in their hospital, but they would now call it a negative patient outcome. Terminology is everything in the 90s, you know that. And so nobody really dies here in this hospital. Oh, sure, we've had our share of negative patient outcomes, but who hasn't, you know? And so somehow if we just ignore the issue, then it'll go away. Just rename it and out of sight, out of mind. But death doesn't play that way. It doesn't go away by simply being ignored. It must be addressed face to face. Every single human being on the face of this planet must look death right in the face and decide, what am I going to do with it? And if nobody's been able to whip it so far, that is of mankind, then I'm not going to whip it either. And I better find out who has whipped it. And Jesus has. And so death, it's an important issue to be dealt with. And he speaks here and he says, this is the book of the genealogy of Adam. In the day that God created man, he made him in the likeness of God. And he created them, male and female, and blessed them and called them mankind in the day they were created. And Adam lived 130 years, and he begot a son in his own likeness after his image. Now, this is very interesting, not in the image of God, but in his own likeness after his image, in other words, fallen. In other words, a sinner. This is all that an Adam can produce, is another Adam, another sinner. And so we're all have inherited depravity. And so he begot a son in his own likeness after his image and called him Seth. And after he begot Seth, the days of Adam were 800 years old, and he begot sons 800 years, and he begot sons and daughters. And so all the days that Adam lived were 930 years, and he died. 930 years. That's a lot longer than any of us could ever live, apart from, you know, the return of the Lord. It's just this, you know, that's an awfully long life. I haven't seen anybody live that long. And Seth lived 105 years, and he begot Enosh. And after he begot Enosh, Seth lived 807 years and begot sons and daughters. And so all the days of Seth were 912 years, and he died. And Enosh lived 90 years and begot Canaan. And after he begot Canaan, Enosh lived 815 years and begot sons and daughters. And so all of the days of Enosh were 905 years, and he died. I'm getting a little depressed here. And Canaan lived 70 years, and he begot Mahalalel. And after he begot Mahalalel, Canaan lived 840 years and begot sons and daughters. And so all the days of Canaan were 910 years, and he died. And Mahalalel lived 65 years and begot Jared. And after he begot Jared, he lived 830 years, begot sons and daughters. And so all the days of this guy were 890 years, and he died. And Jared lived 162 years and begot Enoch. And after he begot Enoch, Jared lived 800 years and begot sons and daughters. And so all the days of him were 962 years, and he died. And Enoch lived 65 years, and he begot Methuselah. And after he begot Methuselah, Enoch walked with God 300 years and begot sons and daughters. And so all the days of Enoch were 365 years. And Enoch walked with God and he was not, for God took him. An interruption in the cycle. An interruption in the cycle. The grave has been dug. The tombstone has been placed for Enoch. And yet there's no body. No body there. What in the world is it that happened here? What is it that caused the interruption of this? And he died, and he died, and he died, and he died. How is it that death has been robbed of its sting and hell of its victory? And the encapsulation of Enoch's life is very, very simple. Enoch walked with God. That's what his life was about. He walked with God. And to walk with God is to engage in an unending walk. And so he was, his walk with God unbroken by death, just like us in Jesus Christ. The Bible teaches that when a Christian dies, he doesn't really die. He moves. He moves from a tent, a temporary dwelling place, and he moves into a body that God has prepared for him that is eternal. And so there is no break in fellowship between God and I at the point where this tent, you know, falls to the ground, wherever that may happen, and then I go to be with the Lord. And so it is with every Christian. And so here we have a picture, really, of what it is that Jesus is able to do. Enoch walked with God. How are we able to walk with God today? We walk with God because of the work of Jesus Christ upon the cross. And Enoch, apparently, all salvation is found in the person and work of Jesus Christ. And Enoch, apparently, looking ahead to the coming of Messiah, even as God had prophesied in Genesis chapter 3 he would come, even so we look back upon Jesus' work upon the cross. But salvation is found in him, and salvation is found in walking with God. And you and I are able to walk with God because Jesus died on the cross for our sins, was buried and rose again, and he has provided the full payment for our sins, and he has defeated death so that we can walk with God. And so he escapes death simply because he walked with God, and he was not, for God took him. And it's very interesting that in the book of Hebrews concerning Enoch, it says, for before his translation, he had this testimony that he pleased God. And so here is a man who walked with God, he pleased God, and God took him. It was that simple. And I love this term walked in verse 24. We'll see it when we get to Noah. Beautiful word, walk. I don't think next to eating together there's anything more conducive to fellowship than walking together. And one of the things is you look at the term walk, it means to go with. And what Enoch did is he looked at the whole scene around him. He said, I don't know what anybody else is going to do, but I'm going to go with God. I'm going to walk with him, just as you and I have done in Jesus Christ. And that was pleasing unto God. And the day came when God took Enoch to be with him, even as the day will come when he will take us to be with him, whether individually or collectively as the church. It's beautiful. The word took there in verse 24, it means to be transferred to another place. It's a pretty good transfer. It's a pretty good transfer. Just to take and to move us out of this old body, this old place, and move us right into his presence before the throne. And so he moved, even as Jesus spoke and said, whosoever believes in me shall never die. Whoever lives and believes in me, he shall never die. Death is defeated in Jesus Christ. I'm so glad. I'm so glad. There's not enough bran. There's not enough vitamin E. There's not enough aspirin. There's not enough bionics. There's not enough of anything to defeat death. And I remember before I became a Christian, I am so thankful that Jesus defeated death. Before I became a Christian, I knew death was my enemy. I was very well aware of it. Just looked like it was, he just looked like he was getting just about everyone I could see. He was doing it. I didn't know anyone that was 900 years old. It's just they're all dead. So I had my Adele Davis books out. I had drinking my milk with lactobacillus, taking my vitamin C tablets with rose hips so that I could get the bioflavonoids, which the regular C didn't have. Taking my bran and running like a maniac to stay in shape and all of these kind of things. And all those things are great, but none of them are going to defeat death. They're not going to do it. And then to come in to a relationship with Jesus Christ and to understand that it's defeated. And I don't think that a person can even begin to enjoy life until death is defeated. And only Jesus can defeat him. So now I drink Pepsis. I eat pizzas. And I also run and I also take care of myself because I want to be around with some semblance of health as long as I can. So there's nothing wrong with that. But I'll tell you, if you sit here tonight concerned about death, as a Christian you shouldn't be. Enjoy life. Enjoy life. But if you're apart from Jesus Christ, apart from a relationship with God, you have legitimate concern, but God has provided you with a legitimate solution in Jesus Christ. Death couldn't hold him. Death couldn't hold him. And Methuselah lived 187 years and begot Lamech. And after he begot Lamech, Methuselah lived 782 years and begot sons and daughters. So all the days of Methuselah were 969 years, and he died. And so here's the oldest guy really listed in the Bible, but he ultimately dies. After 969 years, it's over. So no matter how long a life might be, it always ends in death. And he died, and Lamech lived 182 years and begot a son, and he called his name Noah, which means rest, saying, "This one will comfort us concerning our work and the toil of our hands because of the ground which the Lord has cursed." And after he begot Noah, Lamech lived 595 years and begot sons and daughters, and so all the days of Lamech were 777 years, and he died, and Noah was 500 years old, and Noah begot Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Now it came to pass, when men began to multiply on the face of the earth, and daughters were born to them, that the sons of God saw the daughters of men, that they were beautiful. And they took wives for themselves of all whom they chose. And the Lord said, "My spirit shall not strive with man forever, for he is indeed flesh, yet his days shall be 120 years. And there were giants on the earth in those days, and also afterwards, and when the sons of God came in to the daughters of men, and they bore children to them, those were the mighty men who were of old, men of renown." So here is a description in chapter 6 of a society that is just about to incur the judgment of God, the wrath of God. It's a very fascinating study in light of that. The first thing that he describes here is a characteristic of the days of Noah. And Jesus did say that prior to his return, that it would be as the days of Noah. The first thing you see is that there's a tremendous population explosion going on here, and daughters are born to the men, multiplication all over the face of the earth. And then the sons of God, verse 2, saw the daughters of men, and they involved themselves sexually with these women, these sons of God, with these daughters of men, and the production of this particular sexual relationship is men of renown, giants. And so who are these guys? Who are these sons of God? Well, in the Bible, the word sons of God is a term that is used three times in the Bible. In each place, it is used in reference to angels, always a reference to angels. And so most people look at it and say somehow there is an angelic involvement with women here that produces this men of renown, these giants. The problem is that how in the world do angels involve themselves with women sexually? How does that happen? The explanation most often given is that they simply possessed men, and it was demon-possessed men, men who were possessed by fallen angels who then involved themselves physically with these women, and it produced these giants. The problem with that is we don't know how in the world being possessed by a demon would affect a gene pool to then affect the type of child that would come forth out of that relationship. Others look at this and they say, well, it really doesn't have anything to do with demons. What it's talking about here is that you've got the seed of Seth, which is the godly seed, becoming joined in marriage with the daughters of Cain, and that's what is being produced here. That allows people, it's a little more easy to deal with that because you're dealing with men and women that are just regular men and women. The problem with that, of course, is how does that produce giants? And how does that produce some particular stature of men or men of renown? And what I happen to think is this. I don't know. If I was going to lean towards something, I would lean towards the fact that it does seem to be some kind of demons involving themselves in sexual activity with women, and somehow these giants, and the word giants there in verse 4 literally means fallers. It produced some kind of fallers, but it's translated giants, speaking of the giants in the land when Caleb and Joshua came back, so it can mean giants too. So somehow I think that was involved, but what I'll do is drop back, 10 yards and punt on the thing, and I would say at the very least what you have here is a time of very strong demonic influence and involvement in the sexuality of mankind. And certainly we see that today. And so they took wives. So the second characteristic of Noah's day was tremendous sexual immorality. Tremendous amount of sexual immorality. And the Lord said in verse 3 concerning all of this as he watches it, he says, "My spirit is not going to strive with man forever." It indicates that he was striving with man. He was striving with them. He wasn't just striving with Noah, he was striving with all of mankind on the face of the planet to make them understand that what they were involved in was wickedness. And he looked at them and they were not listening to him, they were not heeding his voice at all, and so he says, "I'm not going to strive with man forever." And he strove through his word, he strove through godly men, and he strove through their consciences, but they refused to listen, even as people refuse to listen to him today. "For he is indeed flesh, yet his days shall be 120 years." There were giants on the earth in those days. Fallers could be a reference to those angels that fell from their first estate. It could be a reference to apostates, or it could be a reference to those who fall upon others to perform violence upon them. And so there were giants or fallers on the earth in those days, and also afterward when the sons of God came into the daughters of men and they bore children to them. Those were the mighty men who were of old men of renown. And then the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth. It's an interesting thing. He noticed the wickedness of man throughout the entire earth. Is there a spot on the face of this planet that is not covered with wickedness? Singapore, I guess, because they just kill everybody who, doesn't toe the line. But I mean, every single bit of this planet, if you were to look at it, you wouldn't look at it and go, "Boy, we got a couple of hot spots of wickedness here, but by and large, it looks pretty good by Yemeni." You look at the face of this planet and you go, is there some square mile anywhere that righteousness reigns, where there isn't wickedness? The whole planet is covered with oppression. It's covered with violence. It's covered with wickedness. It's just as in the days of Noah. It's exactly what it's like. And he looks at it and he saw that wickedness, the wickedness of man, was great in the earth, and that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. I mean, you can't make it any clearer. Every only continually, talking about a total depravity of mankind. So we look at the world that we're in. Jesus gave an additional characteristic of the marks of the last days. He said men would be marrying and giving in marriage, and they'd be feasting. And in other words, men would, in the midst of all of this wickedness, in the midst of all of this perversion, they would just go on about their business as if judgment would never come. It was just, this is the normal thing. It's unrighteous, it's wrong, it's unholy, it's wickedness, but nobody's ever going to call us to account. Now, we have an absolute cow. When you've got somebody out, you know, roaming in the neighborhood or roaming in a city that is, you know, performing acts of violence and injustice and unrighteousness against mankind, we just, why doesn't, you know, somebody do something about this? Law enforcement, do something about this. And we want justice. And yet, isn't it funny how mankind can take and look at mankind as a whole and look at all of the wickedness and say, oh, there really is no standard. There'll never be any judgment coming down. There isn't a just God. We'll never be held accountable for our activity and our actions and our thoughts and our life. And God said, that will be the attitude, as if there is no one greater than them, expecting more of them in terms of a standard. And so that's the world that we live in. And you look at the sexual immorality all over the place. And we have to be very, very careful concerning this issue of sexual immorality today, because it's like, how can I say this? It tells us in the book of Hebrews that marriage is honorable among all, and the marriage bed is undefiled, but fornicators and adulterers God will judge. Sexual activity, the expression of that portion of a relationship between a man and a woman, is to be expressed only within the marriage relationship, only within the realm of a lifelong commitment on the part of both persons to one another. That's where it's to be expressed. And we look around, and we want to be very gracious with people. But the fact of the matter is, anything other than that in terms of sexual intercourse is sin. I don't care if a person comes along and says, well, you know, I've only gone to bed with 7 women this year. I know people that went to bed with 20. I'm doing pretty good, you know. And they were all Christians, Mike, you know, yeah. Yeah, I went to a church, by the way, where the guy, he went to bed with 6 or 8 women in the church before we found out about it, not here. And he justified it. He said, but I witnessed every one of them. Oh, great. Well, we're sorry we called you in on this then. And in his own mind, he had justified it. He had rationalized it by that. That somehow that sanctified. But that is the righteous standard. That's the righteous standard. And so this sexual immorality all over the place, and it is so hard to make a stand. It takes the Spirit of God to make a stand. And those of you who are single, you think, boy, my problems will be over once I get married. Well, you will have an opportunity for expression of that relationship in your marriage relationship, but there is still great temptation related to that. All of the days of your life this side of 110 years old. And so it's important for us to understand that it's wrong. It's wrong. It's sin. And God notices it. And it's important for us to understand, too, that as God looked at the violence on the earth in the time of Noah, that he was greatly upset with it, greatly upset with the violence and the wickedness. And he's greatly upset with it today, greatly upset with it. We'll see him later in places in the Old Testament where he held entire cities accountable for the death of one innocent person. He would hold an entire king and his family responsible for the unjust death of soldiers who had surrendered to him. Life was is precious to God. Man is created in the image of God. And we look around, and it is one of the challenges of our life to open up the paper and, another 172 people slaughtered, yesterday was 175. We're getting better. And just to look into somehow to get hardened at the level of violence and the amount of innocent blood that is falling into the ground, and God takes note of all of it, and he will hold mankind responsible for it. The violence, a sign that we're in the last days. We're in the days of Noah. It's a terrible thing. It's a terrible, terrible thing. Life is so cheap. Oh, you killed someone? And I was watching the news the other day. Again, a stupid thing to do. I was watching in L.A. County, where they were, because they don't have any ability to hold people, they were releasing, not only prostitutes and different things, but they were releasing people that had been arrested for burglary. They didn't have any place to hold them. Now you read the news, and I read the news. A person takes and just kills an innocent person. Just takes and snuffs out their life. They get 6 years. 6 years. Is that what a human life is worth now? 6 years? That's what it's worth? Oh, then no wonder why society comes down and dips down to that level in terms of the value of a human life. Well, is that all I'm going to get or potentially get? It's worth the chance. And it's terrible. And it's wrong. And there'll be judgment. There'll be justice that comes forth because of the amount of violence and innocent blood that is shed. Evil imaginations continually, universal corruption, evil being called good, good being called evil, until those who are involved in sexual immorality and wickedness and violence and evil imaginations become the world's heroes, and they are today. Business as usual. Business as usual. And so that's the scene of what was going on in the days of Noah. May I say that being a preacher in 1993 versus any decade prior, I don't need to stretch these scriptures to make them appear to fit in our day. They fit our day. They absolutely fit our day. And the Lord was sorry that he had made man on the earth, and he was grieved in his heart. And so the Lord said, I will destroy man whom I have created from the face of the earth, both man and beast, creeping thing, and birds of the air, for I am sorry that I have made them. And that's his, as he looks at the entire world. And then notice these two precious words of verse 8. But Noah, he looks all over the entire planet, and his eyes settle on a man who is different. And how important for God to look at our lives tonight and to see the immorality and to see the violence and to see the wickedness and to see the devices, but then to be able to say, but Damien, or but whatever our name might be. What a precious thing. But Noah. And Noah stands in contradistinction to all of that was going on around him, stark contrast to it, and he shows us that you can do it. You can do it. But Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. Where was the grace in Noah? The grace was in the eyes of the Lord. The eyes of the Lord. God looks at him. And then he describes them. This is the genealogy of Noah. Noah was a just man, That's what he was positionally before God. It means to be straight, to be straight. This was a man who was, again, looking ahead to the coming of Messiah. And because he was, God looked at him positionally and said, this is a just man. He is just in my sight. But not only was he just, but it says he was perfect. And the word perfect means blameless, to be whole or complete, to have integrity. He was wholly and completely given himself over to God. And he was perfect or blameless in his generations, which were wicked generations. Then number three, Noah walked with God. He walked in the same direction as God was walking in, not the direction that the entire rest of the world was walking in. And Noah begot three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And the earth was also was corrupt before God. And the earth was filled with violence. It was ruined, and to lay in ruins is what it means there. And so they had destroyed it morally, filled with violence. And so God looked upon the earth, and indeed it was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted their way on the earth. And God said to Noah, the end of all flesh has come before me, for the earth is filled with violence through them, and behold, I will destroy the earth. And God comes in and he warns Noah. Whenever God talks to us, it's important for us to understand that there's a reason, and it's important. And oftentimes when he talks to us, there's the tendency to say, yeah, thank you, God, for telling me that and keeping me up to date as it relates to I don't really need to hear that. That's obvious. And then right around the corner, 48 minutes, 48 hours, all of a sudden, the thing, whatever it is, blasts into our life, and we realize that we needed to be reminded of what it was that God was reminding us of. And so God comes into Noah, and he reminds him. Here, he speaks something to him. And Noah's going to take very, very seriously what God has to say. And he said, make yourself an ark of gopher wood. Make rooms in the ark and cover it with pitch, inside and outside with pitch. And so he says, make this ark. And God, knowing of the judgment that was coming, knew what was going to be required for salvation. And he said, this is what you're going to need, Noah. You're going to need an ark, and here's the dimensions of it. I know what it is that's going to come, and I'm the only one that knows what salvation is going to be sufficient. And he's done the same thing in Jesus Christ. As he looks at our lives, he says, there's a judgment coming. There's a perfect judgment coming. There's a white throne judgment coming. And the only protection, the only salvation that is sufficient for the judgment that I know is coming is found in the person of Jesus Christ. He knows what he's talking about. He knows what he's talking about. And this is how you shall make it. The length of the ark shall be 300 cubits, and its width 50 cubits, and its height 30 cubits. And so here is a boat, an ark that is made, that its total volumetric capacity is over 1,400,000 cubic feet. In other words, you could take 522 railroad livestock cars and put them on the ark. It's a big boat. It's a big job. He had about 120 years to do it. It's a big job. And you shall make a window for the ark, and you shall finish it to a cubit from above, and set the door of the ark on its side. You shall make it with lower, second, and third decks, so it's three stories. And behold, I myself am bringing a flood of waters on the earth to destroy from under the heaven all flesh in which is the breath of life, and everything that is on the earth shall die. But I will establish my covenant with you, and you shall go into the ark, your sons, your wife, and your sons' wives with you, and of every living thing of all flesh you shall bring two of every sort into the ark to keep them alive with you. They shall be male and female. And of the birds after their kind, of animals after their kind, and of every creeping thing of the earth after its kind, two of every kind will come to you to keep them alive. God brought them forward to the ark. Otherwise, that would have been a whale of a roundup to try and get them. They did lose the unicorn, though, you know. Some of you remember the song. I'm not going to sing it. Don't groan. Don't groan on me, Lance. I wasn't going to sing it. But there were some green alligators and long-necked geese. But we won't sing it, Lance. I'm not going to sing it. Some humpy-backed camels and some chimpanzees. Would you? Anybody want to finish that for? I'm just kidding. And you shall take for yourself of all food that is eaten, and you shall gather it to yourself, and it shall be food for you and for them. And thus Noah did according to, and note this word, it's the key to this section, according to all that God suggested. Now there's a second word that's important, commanded him, so he did. Every command of God has a design behind it. There's a reason for it. There's a reason for it. And here is Noah. He takes everything that God called him to do, every single thing he takes and he does. And it's important that he does do it. It tells us in Hebrews 11, verse 7, that being warned of God, he moved with godly fear. He had the fear of God, and he needed the fear of God to build this ark, because you can imagine what kind of a razzing he would have taken in building this ark. It had never rained on planet Earth. The Earth is still being watered by a mist. They've never had any rain. And here he takes and he begins to build an ark. Doesn't begin to build a rowboat or a yacht. He's building a huge ark. You can fit 522 livestock railroad cars in it. This is a big boat. And he begins to build this thing. And you can imagine what the neighbors were thinking as he begins to build this. Hey, Noah, what are you doing out here? I'm building a boat. What's a boat? Right, you're ahead of me. Well, it's something that floats on water in case it floods. What's a flood? Well, it's something that happens when it rains 40 days and 40 nights. What's rain? They didn't know what any of this meant. This is a man of faith. Absolutely a man of faith. And so they began to print their Noah joke books. How many Noahs does it take to replace a light bulb? This kind of thing. And you can imagine the kind of torment that came against him in him doing this for 120 years as he preaches building this boat. And it was the fear of God that kept him obeying. Very important. Very, very important. And so he preached that entire time, and there wasn't a single convert the entire time as he sawed and as he hammered and as he built that ark. They just shook their heads and they laughed at him, all of the common sense people, even as all of the common sense people laugh and shake their heads at you and the hope that is in you. But the day came when the Lord said to Noah, come into the ark. Notice he didn't say go into the ark. His name is, you come. I'm in here, Noah. You come on in. Come into the ark, you and all your household, because I have seen that you are righteous before me, and that's the standard of righteousness in this generation. And you shall take with you seven each of every clean animal, a male and his female, two each of the animals that are unclean, a male and his female, also seven each of birds of the air, male and female, to keep the species alive on the face of the earth. For after seven more days, I will cause it to rain on the earth 40 days and 40 nights, and I will destroy from the face of the earth all living things that I have made. And Noah did according to all, again that word, that the Lord commanded him. What if he didn't do it? What if he didn't do everything that God commanded him to do it? What if he obeyed selectively, like so many obey selectively? What if he decided just to build an ark half the size that God commanded? They'd have lost a lot more than the unicorn, wouldn't they? By the way, they didn't lose a unicorn for those of you. That preacher, he told us there, it was Chicago. And I got the 45 right here. It's right here that says the... What if he decided, sure, I'm going to do it, but I'm not going to do it in 100 years. I'm going to do it in the 200-year plan. I'm going to ease into this thing. What if he built the ark and he didn't get into it? It'd be foolish, wouldn't it? Complete obedience is so important. He obeyed God in everything. He did all. Complete obedience in times of great wickedness. It's the only safe place. And in this day of great wickedness, the only safe place is complete obedience. And it's interesting to me that not only did he obey completely, but he persevered. And that's a mark of faith, persevering. So here's this man in the midst of great wickedness. He obeyed God and he persevered. He persevered until the Lord's return. That's what he waited for. He waited upon God. And Noah was 600 years old when the flood of waters was on the earth. And so Noah with his sons, his wife and his sons' wives went into the ark because of the waters of the flood. Of clean beasts, of beasts that are unclean, of birds, and of everything that creeps on the earth. Two by two, they went into the ark to Noah, male and female, as God had commanded Noah. And it came to pass after 7 days that the waters of the flood were on the earth. And in the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, the 17th day of the month, on that day all the fountains of the deep were broken up and the windows of heaven were opened. It began to rain. And not only did it begin to rain, but all of the fountains, all of the streams, all of the underground water began to just break up out of the earth to begin to flood the earth. And that's why it's interesting as the archaeologists take and look at their geological columns all over the world, that there are vast sections that they come to and it's completely turned upside down. You've got the whole thing laid out and they come to another section and it's upside down. Why? Because the earth is broken up in that kind of a cataclysm that was involved. And the rain was on the earth 40 days and 40 nights. And on the very same day, Noah and Noah's sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, and Noah's wife and the three wives of his sons with them entered the ark. And so Noah's salvation was tied up in, number one, he heard God, he believed God's word, and then he proved his faith by works. There's only one way to be saved, and that was to get on that ark. And they and every beast after its kind, all cattle after their kind, every creeping thing that creeps on the earth after its kind, and every bird after its kind, and every bird of every sort. And they went into the ark to Noah two by two of all flesh in which is the breath of life. And so those that entered, male and female of all flesh, went in as God had commanded him, and the Lord shut him in. And there is a point where God shuts the door. And it was at this point that he shut the door. Now, oftentimes people have a big problem with Christianity because of the fact that Christianity appears to be so exclusive. And we look and we say that Jesus said that he is the way, the truth, and the life, and that no man comes to the Father but by me, Jesus said. And it's a perfect picture here in the ark. Is it was a narrow way of salvation. You had to be on that ark to be saved. But anyone who wanted to could have been on the ark. It was a salvation that was not exclusive. It did not deny anyone access. And so it is with Jesus Christ. It's a narrow way. It's a straight gate. But it's a true way. And no one is denied access to salvation in Jesus Christ. There's room for everyone who will obey. And that's why the disciples, when they looked at Jesus and they said, well, how many will be saved? And he, in essence, spoke to them and said, don't worry about how many are going to be saved. That's not your business. You make sure you're on. That's the concern for mankind, is for them to make sure that they are on. Not an issue of broad or narrow. The issue is the salvation true? That's the issue. The salvation is true in Jesus Christ, and the Lord shut him in. Can you imagine, after watching this guy for 120 years build this ark and laughing at him and having all of the Noah comic books right there with, you know, Calvin and Hobbes and Far Side and everything up there. Oh, that guy kills me out there, what he's doing. What a waste of 120 years. And can you imagine when the first drop fell? Can you imagine when the first drop fell? Can you imagine what would happen to the blood in your head? You go right to your feet. And all of a sudden, in one nanosecond, in one moment in time, they realized, oh no, it's true, he was right. And it's too late. And it's too late. And can you imagine as the water began to creep up to their ankles and up to their knees and up to their waists, all of the panic that would have set in, and all of the patting on the back that had happened in their pseudo-intellectualism and in all of their, you know, vain philosophies of man and all of that kind of stuff, and to realize that this guy was right all along. And the day will come when Jesus will rapture his church, and in that moment in time, a twinkling of an eye, millions of people on the planet are going to realize they were right. I thought they were stupid idiots. Well, they were so foolish to live a life that way when there's all of this violence to enjoy out here. And it isn't that a person can't be saved, a tribulation period, but it's a rough way. It's a rough, rough road. The day comes in which the Lord shuts the door. He shut them in. Now the flood was on the earth 40 days, and the waters increased and lifted up the ark, and it rose high above the earth, and the waters prevailed and greatly increased on the earth. And the ark moved about on the surface of the waters, and the waters prevailed exceedingly on the earth, and all the high hills under the whole heaven were covered, and the waters prevailed 15 cubits upward, and the mountains were covered. So I can't for the life of me understand why there's the big, battle that goes on, or dispute that goes on, whether this was a regional flood that just happened there in the Middle East or whether this was a worldwide flood. Well, it's a worldwide flood. These alls mean something. And the mountains and all prevailing over these things. It was a worldwide flood. And all flesh died that moved on the earth. You have to make it a local flood when your God isn't big enough to do a worldwide flood. And so you've got to really doctor up the Bible after that. And all flesh died that moved on the earth, birds and cattle and beasts and every creeping thing that creeps on the earth, and every man, all in whose nostrils was the breath of the spirit of life, all that was on dry land died. And so he destroyed all living things which were on the face of the ground, both man and cattle, creeping things, and bird of the air. They were destroyed from the earth. Only Noah and those who were with him in the ark remained alive, and the waters prevailed on the earth 150 days. And so we'll stop there, and we'll pick it up in chapter 8 next week.